From Gimlet Media, this is Undone. I'm Pat Walters. This story starts on an old fishing boat out in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California. It's June of 1975.
June 26th, 1975.
This is one of the guys who was on the boat. His name is Rex Wyler, and he was out there with 12 of his friends, a bunch of hippies from Canada. And at this point, they'd been at sea for about 2 months, and things were not going well.
We were low on food. We were low on money. We were really down to the point where we only had a few days of fuel left.
Rex says this crew was on this kind of crazy mission. They were trying to track down this fleet of commercial whaling ships operated by the Soviet Union so they could confront them and demand that they stop killing whales.
It was a rather ambitious and foolhardy campaign.
Paul Watson, another guy in the boat.
We had no idea where the Russian fleet was.
We'd announced that we're going out to stop the whaling, and we didn't even know where to go.
That's another crew member, Patrick Moore.
We were feeling kind of in despair that we were never going to find these Russian whalers.
And then
suddenly we heard Russian voices on the radio.
And there they were on the horizon.
And off we go.
So this group of young people has this radical idea to stop the Soviet whalers. But what they really want to do is a lot bigger than that. They wanted to stop all whaling. And more than that, kind of to save the entire planet. Paul, Patrick, Rex, and the rest of this crew are from Greenpeace, which in June of 1975 was barely a thing. This moment out at sea would launch the new environmental organization onto the worldwide stage and send it on a path from its origins as this tiny group of hippies to an organization with hundreds of employees, offices all over the world, and millions of dollars in donations. This episode is about that moment. It's also about how 40 years later, some of the people from that original movement have come to disagree with each other so deeply that they can't even talk to each other anymore. Okay, so there were 13 people out on the boat that day, but we're going to mostly focus on two of them, the two who have ended up the furthest apart today. The first one is Paul Watson.
I was the first officer under Captain John Cormack on the Greenpeace 5, it was called.
Paul was 24 years old, and ever since he was a little boy, he had been obsessed with protecting animals. It all started for him when he was 10 years old, and this trapper killed these beavers that lived near his house.
So I became pretty angry, and that next winter, I walked the trap lines and freed the animals if they were in them, and then took the leg hole traps, threw them in the river, and I got in trouble for it, but, you know, it was very satisfying.
I always call him the self-styled Rambo of the environmental movement.
That's the second guy, Patrick Moore. He was on this boat fresh out of grad school with a PhD, and he came to this Greenpeace mission from a different angle than Paul. Patrick had heard this lecture about ecology.
Looking at nature in system terms rather than as individual trees or individual birds, and a light just went on when I heard about it. It kind of made me born again in the scientific sense.
Because back in the 70s, this idea of the ecosystem was pretty new, so it was kind of a radical thing to hear about. Rex Wyler, one of the other crew members from the boat, told me that just a few years before they went after the whalers, NASA had published the first color photograph of Earth from space.
And it stunned me. I remember it was the smallness of it. Before that, I think we thought of the Earth as huge. Suddenly, we saw the Earth as something small and delicate and fragile and vulnerable.
And this photograph became iconic.
It's like we'd have posters of Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and the Earth on the wall.
So you could see the beginnings of a modern environmental consciousness happening. The first Earth Day happened in 1970, the EPA was created, and some of the early environmental laws started coming through. But when Patrick, Paul, and Rex looked around, it seemed like environmental destruction was happening everywhere. Greenpeace wanted to change that. The group started small and really informal. They had meetings in a church basement in Vancouver. They were led by a local journalist named Bob Hunter. In the early 70s, Greenpeace did a few campaigns. They protested a nuclear test, demonstrated at a chemical plant, but they wanted to do something bigger.
We were looking for something to do on a global scale.
And this is what brings us to the whales. Greenpeace had been approached by this whale scientist who had come to them and said, like, guys, what you need to do is save the whales. And at first, Greenpeace was like, what?
It sounded like a bizarre thing at the time.
This is Bobby Hunter, another of the first Greenpeacers.
Most people's perception of whales was still 19th century, still sort of Moby Dick.
A whale can stave in the ribs of the biggest ships, swallow whole crews, pick its teeth with the oars.
That's a clip from the 1956 version of the Moby Dick movie.
Brave little men in little boats going out against Leviathan.
But the whale scientists told them, no, that's all wrong. Whales aren't monsters at all.
They had magnificent brains that were larger than ours. They had communication systems. They lived in societies. They had families.
And they're getting massacred.
The whales were being hunted near extinction. The Atlantic gray was already extinct. The bowhead whale was on the verge of extinction.
It was estimated about 25 to 30,000 whales were being killed every year.
Just getting slaughtered by these big commercial whaling fleets. And when the Greenpeacers learned all of this, it hit them. Whales are the thing that can put Greenpeace on the map. They saw them as this perfect symbol. Like the story of what was happening to the whales was kind of the story of what was happening to the whole environment. And Greenpeace thought, since whales are so similar to people, showing the public how vulnerable they are might inspire people to care more about the whole environment. And this is how Paul, Patrick Rex, and the others ended up out in the Pacific in June of 1975. This was their plan. They would go find the Soviet whaling fleet, and to stop the whalers from killing the whales, they would drive these small inflatable boats called Zodiacs out between the whalers and the whales.
We thought that this tactic would work because, you know, we were reading a lot of Gandhi at the time, and we felt that all we had to do is put our lives on the line and you act as human shields.
And the idea wasn't just to save a few whales, but rather to show people how these whalers were the real monsters, not the animals they were hunting. So to do that, Greenpeace would film the whole thing.
We always said that there's the green, there's the peace, and then there's the magic wand, which is the media.
That's Patrick Moore again. And he says the idea was to make a film of this confrontation that was so dramatic, it would basically go viral. Which in those days meant getting on all the big television news shows. Their name for this proto-viral video idea was a mind bomb.
We had this theory that we could create images and through television and radio, we could send out these images and these stories, and this would crack the culture and introduce new ideas into people's minds on an international level.
So Patrick, Paul, Rex, and the rest of this crew get their hands on an old fishing boat and set off to find the Soviets. This is a recording from the boat. Remember, there are a bunch of 20-somethings in 1975.
You know, we drank wine and smoked pot and sang songs.
But they also took this mission really seriously. Every day they practice in their inflatable boats. And then finally, near the end of June, Greenpeace found the Soviets.
There were 9 harpoon boats. They were onto a pod of whales.
And the Greenpeace crew jumped into their little Zodiac boats to chase after the whalers.
I mean, immediately, it was far more chaotic than we had ever imagined.
So there are 3 of these small boats out there. Bob Hunter, the leader of the group, is in one. He died in 2005. Paul Watson, the Rambo guy, is in another. Patrick Moore, the PhD, is in another one. So they're out there in these small boats,
chasing the whales, clicking along on the Zodiacs, bouncing up and down. Stuff's falling out, people are falling over.
Because it's not easy to get a small Zodiac in front of a harpoon boat going 20 knots on the high seas.
Our job was to get between the harpoon and the pod of fleeing whales, or 8 sperm whales that were fleeing for their life.
Eventually, they do it. And so they're bouncing along, trying to keep their boats in between the whalers and the whales to block them from launching a harpoon. And at one point, Paul, the environmental Rambo guy, looks up, and he sees this guy sitting at a giant harpoon cannon.
And then the captain on the harpoon vessel came down the catwalk and screamed into the ear of the harpooner. Then he looked at us and smiled and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when I realized that, we were seriously in trouble.
You guys must have been terrified.
Well, I don't know. Just speaking for myself, I've never had any real fear in these circumstances.
Why do you have a sense of why not? Because it seems like that seems weird to me.
I think fear is irrational.
I think a lot of people do, but it's still hard not to feel it. But not everyone out there felt that way.
Just to put it bluntly, I was scared.
Rex again.
Suddenly here I am with this giant exploding cannon right behind me, aimed at me. I was shaking.
And the thing you have to know about these harpoons is that each one has a grenade on the end of it that explodes when it goes into the whale. So putting yourself in front of one is really dangerous.
I knew that if this harpoon even glanced off our boat, it would blow us out of the water.
And then all of a sudden,
there was this horrendous explosion and this 150-pound harpoon flew over our head and slammed into the backside of one of the whales in front of us. And it was a female whale, and she screamed.
There was blood all over the water.
The sea turned red. And I mean really deep red all around the whales.
Suddenly, the largest whale in the pod threw himself out of the water straight at the harpooner on the Soviet vessel. But they were waiting for him. And as the whale rose up out of the water, he pulled the trigger and hit the whale in the head at point-blank range. And we were just sitting there transfixed watching this.
And right then, Paul says,
and I looked at this eye, it was an eye the size of my fist, and what I saw there actually changed my life forever, because what I saw was understanding.
And Paul says at that moment, the whale sort of twisted away from their boat and fell backwards into the water.
With a great effort, he pulled himself back and began to slide back into the sea. And I saw his eye disappear beneath the surface, and he died.
So these guys are out there in their little boats, surrounded in whale blood, and they're devastated, because this is exactly what they were trying to prevent. But in another sense, it's also kinda exactly what they needed, because right when the whalers launched that harpoon, the crew was filming. They had the whole thing on tape.
Open quote, "They didn't give a damn."
That's Bob Hunter, transmitting a report on what happened that day over the radio.
"Whether they blasted us out of the water or not, comma, unquote."
He sounds pretty robotic, but according to Bobby, who was back on land receiving these messages, you kind of had to be all business over the radio.
Because you can get cut off and then go, crack, crackle, you know, like, and then all of a sudden, you know, you can't get what he's saying.
So even though it doesn't sound like they were celebrating,
we were just so excited. We knew we had it. We were thrilled to death.
Bobby called the news in San Francisco, told them Greenpeace is coming in with some film and you're going to want to see it. By the time the boat got back to land, there was a huge crowd waiting for them.
We come into San Francisco, we come under the Golden Gate Bridge, come into the bay.
And we're mobbed at the dock by media and public.
It is madhouse. It is packed. We can hardly believe it. There's hundreds of people. And we come in and there's cheers and people singing and clapping.
We were made into celebrities overnight.
The Greenpeace crew gave their film to the news, and the story exploded.
Boom. All over the world. And I go to the newsstand, and there are all those photographs.
These images of giant industrial whaling ships killing small, vulnerable whales were suddenly everywhere.
It was very lucky that we got that shot. And that was really like a shot that was heard around the world and really got the anti-whaling movement started.
We brought the Save the Whales movement into everyone's living room for the first time.
So these guys, Paul the Enviro Rambo, Patrick with the PhD, and the rest of this crew had set off their mind bomb. And this is the reason saving the whales became such a big thing. It's why you probably grew up with posters of whales, and why people go on whale watching trips. It changed how we think about them, and it really did help save them. By the early 1980s, the International Whaling Commission instituted a moratorium on commercial whaling. And over the next 30 years, the number of whales killed every year would plummet, from tens of thousands in the 70s to less than a couple thousand now. And over that time, Greenpeace grew from that small counterculture crew who tracked down the Soviets to a massive international organization. And the two guys we've been talking about the most, Paul Watson, the Rambo, and Patrick Moore, the PhD, helped build it for a while. After the break, we'll talk about their split from Greenpeace, what happened afterwards, and how these two guys, who came together to help launch the environmental movement, went off in astonishingly different directions. So before the break, we told you about how a group of activists formed Greenpeace and took on these Soviet whalers, and about how what they did that day helped lead to a ban on commercial whaling, changed the way we see whales, and launched Greenpeace to global attention. In the years after that anti-whaling mission, Paul Watson, the Rambo guy, and Patrick Moore, the PhD, kept working with Greenpeace to fight whaling and seal hunting and nuclear weapons. But they both eventually left the organization. And when they did, they ended up going off in wildly different directions from each other. So let's talk about Paul first. Paul got kind of famous several years ago for this reality TV show he had on Animal Planet.
They've tied both of them to the vessel, and they're refusing to let them go.
Still very uncertain.
It's called Whale Wars, and it follows this anti-whaling organization Paul created called the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which basically does the same thing the early Greenpeacers did that day in 1975 with the Soviets, but with bigger boats and more aggressive tactics. Like, instead of just driving his boat in between whalers and whales, Paul's crew will pull up alongside and throw smoke bombs at them, or climb on board. And sometimes they just straight up ram their boats into the whaling ships. Paul claims to have sunk several. And what Paul does now, and the reason he does it on his own and not with Greenpeace, all kind of goes back to that day in 1975 out at sea with the Soviets. Paul says watching the Soviet whalers kill that whale right in front of him was a turning point.
From that moment on, how that changed my life is I decided that I would dedicate my life to protecting whales and the creatures in the sea.
And pretty soon, Paul started feeling like Greenpeace's tactics weren't strong enough.
I didn't want to protest anymore. To me, protesting was very, very submissive. It's like, you know, please don't do this. Don't kill the whales. And of course, they do it anyway because they don't really care. So I felt we had to be more aggressive.
So Paul started doing things Greenpeace did not approve of. Like this one time, at a protest of a seal hunt, Patrick Moore says Paul
chained himself to a pile of seal carcasses that were attached by a cable to the ship and was winched into the water where he almost died.
Patrick says Paul almost drowned before some other Greenpeacers were able to get him back on land.
Caught us completely by surprise, and it wasn't the kind of tactic that Greenpeace would normally do.
And stuff like this is why, in 1977, the board voted him out. The vote was 11 to 1. Paul was the only one who voted for himself. So Paul left and created Sea Shepherd. Greenpeace and others have been critical of Paul's tactics. And in 2012, Interpol issued a red notice against Paul for allegedly breaking into and damaging a Japanese whaling ship. But Paul's old friends from that first anti-whaling trip still respect him. Rex Weiler, one of the crew members.
I wish he was not so confrontational to other environmentalists, but he never sold out the movement. He's still out there working for the animals, and I give him a lot of credit for that.
So that's Paul Watson. The second guy, Patrick Moore, the PhD, his story has gone very differently.
People should sort of wake up to the fact that the climate stopped warming more than 10 years ago.
This is from a TED Talk Patrick gave in 2009.
Antarctica never did get warm. It has remained cold, and the sea ice around Antarctica has not shrunk in the slightest.
So Patrick Moore, former president of Greenpeace, now says climate change isn't a problem. Okay, let's rewind back to the 70s. At the same time Paul's relationship with Greenpeace was deteriorating, Patrick was chosen to lead the organization by Bob Hunter, the guy who had led it from the beginning. And over the next several years, Patrick and his wife Eileen, and Bob and Bobby, who by this point were married, got really close. Bobby says they hung out all the time.
We went on fun trips together. We had our kids at the same time. We laughed, we giggled, we intellectualized, we reminisced, we had fun together.
And Greenpeace was growing. This was a big time for the organization. Branches opened in lots of other countries. But as the years went by, Patrick's relationship with Greenpeace gradually unraveled. Some of the early Greenpeace members we talked to said he was pretty hard to work with. Here's Rex.
People didn't particularly like working with him. He also was a bit of a bully.
And for his part, Patrick says Greenpeace was changing in ways he disagreed with. He felt like they were getting too extreme. He says the movement started off with a very strong humanitarian orientation. But by the early 80s, it had become, in his words, anti-human.
The human species was being described as the enemy of nature, the enemy of the earth.
And all this tension came to a head in 1986, when Patrick left Greenpeace. Afterwards, he moved home and started a fish farm. A few years later, the market bottomed out, and he closed the farm. Around that time, he ended up getting invited to do some work with the logging industry. His dad had run a logging company, so he had some connection to that world. And he took the job. To Patrick's old Greenpeace friends, this looked like getting into business with the enemy. They have different theories about why Patrick switched sides. Some say it was about money. Some say he was mad at Greenpeace. But Patrick says he didn't switch sides at all.
The way I see it is I actually helped bring about much more sustainable practices in the forest industry of Canada.
And soon Patrick started branching out and consulting with other industries.
Like the Vinyl Institute, for example, the Nuclear Energy Institute. I have worked for the Mining Association of Canada to help them reform their practices and also to defend them where they're being wrongly and falsely accused.
And Bobby says this was really hard for her and Bob to watch.
It was a very huge, huge, huge and sad thing to see Pat's attitudes and viewpoints move away from being an environmental crusader to being on the payroll of the big companies.
Bobby says she and her husband tried to bring Patrick back into the fold.
Bob wrote a few times to him to try to get him to straighten out.
But she says Bob didn't really make any progress. And in 1994, Bob Hunter, the man who had once put Patrick Moore in charge of Greenpeace, wrote a newspaper column that called Patrick the Judas of the eco movement.
It was like really very gut-wrenching to have one of your best friends tell all your other friends that you're gone over to the dark side and are the eco-Judas.
Rex, another of the early Greenpeacers, says he remembers getting into these long debates with Patrick.
I used to go to the pub with him in Vancouver, and I argue with him, Pat, why are you saying this stuff? You know this isn't true. So I took him in a few cases in the media. You know, he would write something, and I would rebuttal, and I would respond.
Paul Watson, the Rambo guy who started Sea Shepherd, he did that too. Bobby says eventually she and Bob had to make a rule with Patrick. They said, we can still hang out, but we can't talk about environmental stuff.
We'll talk about kids. We can talk about maybe the old days. Limited conversation.
But she says the rule didn't really work.
Because Pat kept wanting to jump in and spout his opinions on things, but Bob and I always shut him down. And I think we had about one or two of those visits, and then that was the end of it.
And one by one, these conversations between Patrick and his old Greenpeace friends stopped. As for Patrick's relationship with Paul Watson, they haven't seen each other in years. The most contact they have anymore is the occasional feud on Facebook. The most recent one we could find was from 2 years ago. Patrick had done an interview for a magazine, and Paul disagreed with a lot of what he said, so he wrote a 3,000-word post taking down each of Patrick's responses in the magazine interview, point by point. Its title, More Corporate Crap from the Eco-Judas. Decades ago, Patrick Moore, Paul Watson, and the rest of this crew got on a boat together and helped start a movement. And now, they can't even talk to each other. And when I think about this, I think what feels kind of sad about it to me isn't just that this particular group can't talk to each other, but that it feels like their split represents something bigger, something that's happening in our country. We have such a hard time talking to people we disagree with about things like this. And we're in a moment when doing that seems more important than ever. Because the biggest environmental problems today are different than the ones Greenpeace faced in the 70s. They're often not these specific, concrete, terrible things you can point to and just say, stop doing that, like killing whales. They're big and abstract and incredibly complicated, like climate change, which we can't fix by ramming a boat into it. Or by saying, it's not a problem. Undone is hosted and produced by me, Pat Walters, with Julia DeWitt and Emmanuel Berry. Our senior producer is Larissa Anderson. We are edited by Alan Burdick and Caitlin Kenny. Production assistance by Isabella Kulkarni. Undone is mixed and scored by Bobby Lord. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris. Special thanks to Jerry Rothwell, Ron Precious, Emily Hunter, Carly Truman, and Bunny McDiarmid. Undone was conceived in collaboration with our friends at Retro Report, the documentary film series that connects iconic news events of the past to today. You can find them at retroreport.org. If you want to get in touch, follow us on Twitter at Undone Show or email us at undone@gimletmedia.com. You can subscribe to Undone on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, please write a review. We're taking a few weeks off for the holidays and to get the next episode ready. We'll see you in 2017.
Hey, Pat.
Hey, Isabella. So you've been doing research for this story.
That I have.
And you have a piece of tape, I guess, that didn't fit?
Yeah. So one of the things that I found was music from the expedition. There were three musicians on board this campaign against the whalers. They had an underwater sound system on board with speakers set up for the whales.
All right. Let's hear this recording. Wow. Is there any evidence that the whales responded?
Yeah, I mean, they found the whales. It's unclear whether or not, like, if it was this weird noise that they were playing that helped the whales come.
Wow, so maybe it worked.
Maybe.